Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 305's fourth episode, special quarantine edition. I am here in Chicago with the only person I'm allowed to not social distance with, Catherine Dvorak, who is a local actress and artist.
Thanks for having me back, Jonathan. I really appreciate it.
I'm so glad you managed to make it all the way from the bedroom to the couch in order to conduct this interview.
I had to change pants in between the last time I saw you and now so I'd be comfortable for this.
That's true, and yeah. I appreciate that sacrifice in this time of great struggle.
Yeah, well, just for you.
Yeah. This evening we are watching The Lady Vanishes by Alfred Hitchcock. It is number 4 in the Criterion Collection. This disc, again, does not have any special features on it, just a nice essay on the back from Michael Wilmington. It is the fourth movie that Hitchcock made after our previous episode, The 39 Steps. Came out in 1938, and is still in the same line of British sort of comedy thriller romance hybrids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a feeling this is going to be a lot more serious than 39 Steps. This is going to be a little bit more of the Hitchcock that I thought I knew.
We'll find out.
I guess so.
We could be surprised once again.
Yeah.
This movie stars Margaret Lockwood and Michael Redgrave.
Never heard of them.
Can't say I have either.
Did Hitchcock have a tendency to cast relative unknowns? It seems like that was a theme in 39 Steps. Is that maybe just for his earlier work?
I think in these cases, they're unknown to us.
Okay. Yeah.
But I remember in reading about 39 Steps, those lead actors had, let's see, they hadn't done a whole lot of film, but they were known in Britain for their work, like in the theater. We'll have to look up some more info about Margaret and Michael after this. So with that, we will take our usual break here and check out the film. Hope you all are doing well and staying safe and healthy out there.
Yeah, cheers.
Be right back.
Heard of Harry Lime?
Best friend I ever had.
So you're going to find me the real criminal. Sounds like one of your stories.
You never should have gone to the police, you know.
Come out, whoever you are.
Don't forget to keep an eye out for the 305's fifth episode featuring the 1949 British film noir classic, The Third Man, directed by Carol Reed, starring Joseph Cotten and the man himself, Orson Welles. Welcome back, everybody. It is now Lady Vanishes day plus 3, I think.
Yeah, we're not really good at being timely about this so far when there's no pressure to record our thoughts and feelings immediately. Yeah.
And also, time has lost all meaning.
Yes,
in this global emergency.
Mm-hmm. I forgot it was Friday.
It is. Happy Friday.
Yeah, well, happy Friday to you.
Thank you. So we watched The Lady Vanishes. I'm going to give the quick plot synopsis for anybody who didn't actually bother to watch it. This is the last of Hitchcock's British films before he went to Hollywood. We open with a bunch of stranded travelers in a fictional, I think, Eastern European country called Bandrika.
Mm-hmm.
They're all waiting for the train. There's like an avalanche or a snowstorm or something ahead that stopped the train. We get to meet the characters in sort of an extended introduction. And then finally, they get on the train. As they're getting on the train, it becomes clear that there are nefarious agents at work because a pair of hands knocks a potted plant off a roof and conks our female lead on the head, even though it was meant for an elderly lady. She is helped on, what's her name, Iris?
Oh, God. Yes.
I think it's Iris.
I should have written down the names.
In fact, I wrote it down.
Hey.
Because of the last time.
Look at you.
So Iris and Mrs. Froy board the train. Mrs. Froy is taking care of her. They go have some lunch. They go back to the compartment. Iris passes out. When she wakes up, Mrs. Froy is gone. And at this point, we have the classic example of gaslighting, where everybody she talks to in her compartment across the entire train claims that she has been alone the whole time, that there was never a Mrs. Froy, they've never seen an old woman with her.
Mm-hmm.
None of this happened. And the whole movie is about Iris trying to piece together like how she could possibly be mistaken about these vivid memories.
Mm-hmm.
Helped in her case is the guy who I did not write down his name. Did you?
You can call him the musician. That's what I have
written down. Yeah, the musicologist.
Musicologist.
Right, because he's studying tribal music when he's in Bendrika.
We are first introduced to him when he's like having a rehearsal in his room at the very top of the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got like three silly people dancing around to his music. And we never see them again. We never get an explanation of, like, if he's rehearsing for something. He was just practicing with a random group of people that served absolutely no purpose to the rest of the story.
It's very subtle, and I did have to look it up afterwards. But he is, he's there because he's researching local musical traditions. And they are performing some kind of a wedding dance for him. He's playing the music and witnessing their dance in order to understand more about their, like, local culture.
Oh, gosh. It seemed like he was just rehearsing for his own, like, sake because he wasn't even watching them at all. Like,
yeah.
I remember him looking down at the music and not even glancing up at them aside from telling them to keep dancing.
I don't know.
Wow. Okay.
So anyway, the very charming musicologist is also on the train. He believes her a little bit, or at least is attracted enough to her to try and help her out, determining the source of this mystery. And eventually we start finding out that various people have various reasons for hiding the truth. It's very much a sort of ensemble film. We've got various side characters.
People from all walks of life.
Yeah. There's a couple having an affair. There's a couple of pals who are presumably on vacation together and desperate to get back to see the cricket finals. As well as the other inhabitants of Iris's compartment, who are like, there's a magician, there's an elderly woman, a young family, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, you know, we sort of find out the traditional Hitchcock mystery details, that there's this convoluted political plot.
Mm-hmm.
There's a secret being held by the old woman that needs to get across enemy lines and in order to, you know, save the British Empire against presumably impending World War II. And after a grand finale shootout on the train, everybody makes it off safely except for the jerk in the affair and makes it back to Britain with the crucial piece of evidence that they need in order to save the war effort. So with that being said, we're going to actually dig into this because this was the first, we're only four episodes in, but this is the first movie that both myself and my guest did not care for.
Yeah, I was just not into it. It like moved very slowly, I gotta say. Mm-hmm. And I have rarely been so frustrated as to watch a woman be gaslit as long as this poor woman was. And I wrote it down in my notes that everybody was willing to throw her under the bus for their own reasons, as you had mentioned. Like, mm-hmm. two people were worried that her plight was going to get them stranded on the train even longer than they had already been held back, and were worried they were going to miss their game. The couple that was having the affair naturally was worried about, like, what they had at stake. The woman in the affair almost decided to help, but then realized she wasn't actually going to get her partner to divorce his wife by admitting that she had actually seen Mrs. Froy, who was in fact the lady that vanished. And so it was just hard watching all these people in their own little worlds not considering that this woman had just lost her friend for some unknown reason. It was like an elderly woman too, so even though they had seen it, they had clearly no care in the world for what happened to this poor sweet old lady. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was just hard to watch.
Now that you say that, I put together maybe a piece of what might be kind of the only like interesting tidbit about the movie, was that it was in reading about the reception of the movie and how critics received it, a lot of people noted what they felt were very strong allegories or parallels to World War II coming up, because this movie came out in 1938. They haven't quite joined the war, but the Nazis are definitely in power. A lot of crazy stuff is starting to happen. And I thought on first reading that seemed like kind of a flimsy case.
Mm-hmm.
But now that you mentioned that so many of these supporting characters were just serving their self-interest and willing to ignore like an obvious problem, mm-hmm. now I'm like, oh, mm-hmm. okay, that I could see as like
as countries benefiting economically from other countries that may have this terrible thing happening, but because, you know, the dictatorship is hushing how bad things really are, and also because other people are okay as long as they're winning in the end. Like, of course the countries are represented or at least paralleled by the characters that were on the train.
So
did they say
of...
like if they were direct parallels to countries?
No.
Specifically? Okay.
I mean, none of what I like summaries that I read did.
Okay.
But I could definitely...
It's not that heavy-handed?
Yeah, I could see maybe at least a case being made for that. And like, for example, early on in the movie, something that I noticed right away is that the two English cricket pals,
mm-hmm.
and I forget their names, but just as an aside, they were written specifically for the movie. They weren't in the book that this was based on.
Hmm.
And they were so popular that they ended up starring in a bunch of other movies over the course of the next couple decades as those
Whoa.
Characters. It was like those characters would show up in various films either as the leads or as supporting characters.
Good
just
for
sort
them.
Of these weird travelers.
They kind of had that vibe. I don't think I've ever seen them in anything else together.
Mm-hmm.
But they had that Abbott and Costello
mm-hmm.
sort of vibe where it's like, oh, look at this duo just chumming about town. Well, that's cool. Good for them.
Yeah.
That's
but
interesting because that was not as large of a role, but they managed to still stand out that much. I guess there wasn't much else in the movie that...
Yeah, well, part of it was that the writers really liked those characters that they had come up with, so they started writing them into more.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. Because it was also a duo of writers who were, like, pals.
Mm.
Anyway, when we are first introduced to them in this foreign country in the hotel, like, some of the first jokes are about them looking around and just going like, why doesn't anybody speak English? I don't understand what's going on. Because they're all sort of babbling in this made-up Italian-esque mm-hmm. Bandrico language.
It's very finessed.
Yeah, it was funny that even in the 30s, that was a stereotype of English speakers, much like America is today, that like, they don't bother, they're uncultured, they don't know anything about the world, they don't understand why everybody else doesn't conform to their ideas of what's good.
Utterly helpless when they're in an area where only, or like, there's no other English speakers. Like,
yep.
Yeah. Can't do anything.
Yeah.
But because they were only like one of the few guests that could, you know, that spoke English, there were a lot of really fun bits made up about them being gay and being a couple.
Mm-hmm.
So the maid, or just the lady who was taking care of the inn,
mm-hmm.
Was, you know, smiling at them, trying to give them privacy, like whenever she had to go into her bedroom, which is where the two Englishmen ended up having to stay because the inn was overcrowded. Anytime she had to like go into their room and grab something, she was very polite, always tried to excuse herself with a smile. And it seemed like they were actually pretty nice to homosexuals back then. Like, you would surprise
well,
there'd
at least
be
a, in foreign countries.
Or at least in foreign countries. You're right. That's the detail that really brings it all together. But I was happy with how just like natural people seemed about it in
yeah.
this movie.
It was nice that it was just a subtle joke.
Yeah.
Rather than them being like extremely flustered by the whole concept of it.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It wasn't like a huge bit that was played throughout the whole movie. It was just like a cute little thing at the start. And then it was ignored.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Well, so I guess all of that is to say that there's, you know, we do get introduced to these characters at the beginning. I think everybody is there. Is the only ones we don't know yet are the adultery couple who are on the train or like somewhere else, and we don't meet them until Mrs. Froy stumbles into their room on the train.
I think you see them briefly at the counter. When everybody else is huddled around the inn, but I don't think you see the magician and the woman that he's with, who claims is his wife,
yeah.
who are apparently in on the whole thing the whole time.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, these, we have this really long introduction to show us these characters and like how they meet and a little bit about them. But the thing that struck me was that, it's like all of it is unneeded.
Mm-hmm.
It really doesn't add anything to the plot. It doesn't give us any crucial details about these people's lives.
Yeah.
There's no backstory introduced. It's just like a little bit of relationship development of how these characters are going to interact through the rest of the film.
Uh-huh.
And I clocked it because unfortunately this was a movie where I was actively looking at the time wondering how much longer we had.
Which says a lot.
It is 25 minutes into the movie before anything exciting happens.
And
not just exciting, but like anything plot related happens, which is when the busker, the guitar player outside of the hotel, dies mysteriously. A pair of hands appear out of nowhere and strangle him.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't even know why in that moment. You figure it out much later. If you think back, it's like, oh, okay, it's because he was part of this plot of the conspiracy, but
mm-hmm.
like that's, they've wasted 25 minutes
to get to that point.
Yeah, to get to like, well, you know, what's even going on here. You don't even know. It was mentioned in one of the critical reviews as a positive, where they're like, oh yeah, this is classic Hitchcock, where like he's really misleading you at the beginning.
They're all
as to
red
what's
herrings.
Going on.
Yeah,
to the point that like you don't know who the main character is for a while, because at first you think it's the two English guys.
Oh, yeah.
They're the first ones you see, and who the camera focuses on. And it's not really until they get on the train half an hour in that you discover, oh, it's this, like, young woman
mm-hmm.
who we don't know anything about.
Right, well, we learn early on from her and her two gal pals who are for some reason with her in this moment, that like 1 week from that day she's supposed to be married. Mm. She's resigned herself to marrying some wealthy somebody so that because she's claimed she's done everything.
Yeah, she's an adventuress.
She's an adventuress. What were the three things that she mentioned that she's done that are all so trivial that she like considers?
I think it all had to do with exploring. It was like, I've seen the Taj Mahal, I've gone to the depths of Japan, that kind of stuff.
I remember the third one being something ridiculous. And I drank like this special tea
from
a cup or whatever.
I've had a 700-year-old whiskey. Now's the time to get married because that's the only adventure left.
Yes. And she was super bummed out about it. Like, my God, she was so bummed out. And her two friends were just like, yeah, well, like, I mean, you don't have to marry him, though. And she was so determined that that was going to be her fate.
Yeah.
So how Iris meets the musician is that he's making a huge ruckus watching the rehearsal, supposedly, in his room. And naturally it makes a bunch of sound down below and it interrupts Iris's sleep, and so she tells the hotel manager to basically break it up. And eventually there's a whole back and forth. The poor hotel manager is just like the messenger for them both. And she ends up bribing the hotel manager to kick him out. Like, she pays him off. And naturally, it's a dick move. It's a pretty big way to escalate the situation, because I can't imagine there are many other inns that that guy could go to. So his response is to go down into a room, basically set up shop, like,
while she's in bed.
Yeah, while she's in bed. Like, she has tucked herself in. She has negligee stuff, like, hanging on the banisters. And, like, she is totally vulnerable. And he just, like, barges right in.
His name is Gilbert, by the way.
Ah, Gilbert. Thank you. And Gilbert, he even gets to the point where he's on the other side of her bed and like rolls over her, over the cushions, like totally. If we were to see that in a movie these days, everybody would be up in arms, just totally uncomfortable at the fact that this stranger barged into her apartment. But naturally, I called it, or I clocked it pretty early on. I wrote it down in my notes. Calling it now, bitter musician is going to hook up with the bitter young English lady that tried to quiet the musician. There. I think I got that within the first, like, 15 minutes.
Yep.
Anyways, it's not my favorite way to discover that a couple is going to be destined to get together later on in the... I didn't care for either of them at that point.
Yeah, there's not much likable about either one.
Yeah.
Like, he's a cad, and she doesn't seem to have much of a personality, to be honest.
Yeah.
Anyway, they do get on the train eventually, and then the movie itself starts. And that was the point at which I thought, like, this is where the movie should have started, is everybody's on the train platform waiting to board the train. You take 5 minutes to show us the, like, five characters, and then they get on the train.
It's like we didn't need so much exposition.
Yeah. I think part of it is that I suspect this was a very literal adaptation in most ways of the book. Because reading the plot of the book, it tracked pretty closely. They added some characters for the movie. They changed the ending a little bit.
Where it's like you don't get that very often these days, where the movie or TV show is that closely followed. Yeah.
But so there was, like, in the book, it does start with this extended opening scene in the hotel and everything. I just think they should have cut to the point for the movie. So anyway, once they get on the train, then I started noticing, or just thinking a little bit more about, like, the technical parts of the movie, I guess. Like, it's surprising that there's no music in this movie. There's a score over the opening credits, and there's a score over the closing credits.
Oh my God, you're right.
And aside from that, it's like there's this melody, which turns out to be the like kind of coded clue that needs to be remembered, but that's it. It is a dry soundtrack.
You're totally right.
Yeah. And supposedly Hitchcock wanted to do that in order to like up the sort of gritty realism of parts of this. I don't know if he really succeeded in that way. Because it just makes things sound a little hollow. And like there, it just feels like there's a lot of dead air.
Yeah, I guess the moment that immediately comes to mind that could have benefited from some sort of sound in the background would have been the fight in the baggage car.
Sure.
So about the time that Iris and Gilbert start piecing together all of the weird things that are happening on the train, the magician that was in the car when Iris was originally with Ms. Troy before she went missing. Anyways, they get attacked by the magician after learning one of his tricks, which ended up also not helping the conspiracy in any way.
It's an illusion, it's Michael.
Right. So there are a bunch of illusion shit in the baggage car. They learn how one of his tricks work and get attacked, and it is the most awkward fight I think I've ever seen in a film. It's clumsy, and normally I like clumsy because that makes it more natural. It's like not everybody is able to be like what John Wick,
right,
and throw the perfect punch every dang time and kick and look good doing it and not get exhausted. I also haven't seen all of John Wick, so I'm just
fine.
Like, okay. I still got that pretty.
You can get right. It from the trailer.
Got it. Okay. So it is clumsy, there's no sound behind it. They're basically shoving each other the whole time, like half choking each other, kind of like pushing and clawing their heads away from each other while also holding on. It's weird. And they just fumble over each other. Iris is hopping around like a grasshopper, and it's even called out in one moment by Gilbert when they're rolling around on the floor. What does he say? It's like, don't hop around like a deer.
Like a referee.
Don't hop around like a referee.
Yeah, because she looks like she's just like looking over a boxing or a wrestling match.
Oh, yeah, yeah. One of the least helpful people in a fight that lasted far too long, too.
Long time.
It was so long. They ended up getting the upper hand and then putting the magician inside a box. Turns out it's one of the magician's box, and so there was a
false back.
Yeah, there was a false back, so he gets away.
You know what it reminded me of?
What?
Yeah, you're pointing out kind of that music would have helped. The scene is reminiscent of that YouTube parody of the Dancing in the Streets music video with David Bowie and Mick Jagger.
Oh, yeah.
Where they took out the music and just added Foley.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Because it really is just like the fight scene is just coughs and footsteps and like the sound of boxes being moved around in the train.
The occasional.
Essentially.
So other than that, like, clearly I had no idea that there wasn't any music or sound throughout. I guess like the constant sound of the train maybe made it a little bit less obvious.
Yeah. Once they got on
the train. Yes.
So as we mentioned, this, like, most of the plot is just about people denying that Mrs. Freud exists. Time after time, and no matter how much evidence Iris or Gilbert stumble on, that like they just won't give up the secret. And so they seem to come up with increasingly elaborate ways of hiding the truth from Iris, to the point that like one of the crucial pieces is that they make a stop on the train in the city, and you see doctors carrying in a gurney with a person who is completely wrapped in bandages.
And also with the gurney is a nun.
Yes, a nun. And they are being brought on so that the doctor, who is another character we were introduced to on the train, can presumably operate on this accident victim. They're taking them to some better facility somewhere.
So, do you think, because the doctor who's on board the train, who is supposed to perform this surgery, do you know his name?
I don't recall.
Okay. So, the doctor, when he bumps into Iris, he learns mm-hmm. pretty early on that she got hit in the head mm-hmm. and is suffering this huge headache. So, when Miss Froy is gone and suddenly... you know, they're trying to find her. The doctor blames Iris's idea
concussion,
of, like,
yeah.
Mrs. Freud being there on a concussion and saying, oh, yes, this is a typical symptom from people who suffer head injuries. And so mm-hmm. I'm wondering if he took on the role of a doctor, specifically like a head doctor
mm-hmm.
or a brain doctor. I know there's a better...
A neurosurgeon?
A neurosurgeon specifically? Is that what he claimed to be? Or was
no.
he more of a
I don't remember what he claimed
psychologist?
To be.
Okay. He claimed to be somebody that had, like, specialized in brain injuries
oh,
of
I
some
see.
Sort. And I'm wondering if he decided to take on that persona after realizing that the wrong person was hit in the head with the brick. Or
right.
if, like, he realized that that was the only way that they were going to get around her remembering Mrs. Froy
mm.
and trying to convince her that Mrs. Froy didn't exist. Or if that was just his cover the whole time and it just ended
mm-hmm.
up working.
Well, that's part of why I started along this line of thinking was that it's bizarre that the action starts with the wrong person getting hit on the head at the train station.
Mm-hmm.
Which means... that the plan the whole time from this nefarious group of foreign agents
mm-hmm.
was to kill or knock out this old woman before she even got on the train.
Yeah.
And yet somehow, after getting on the train, there are at least 6 foreign agents embedded in the train
mm-hmm.
in her compartment. Like, they didn't even know which compartment she was going to be in, but somehow... Mrs. Froy and Iris end up in the compartment with all the bad guys.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the doctor's there, and so on. So they had to improvise on the train how they were going to pull off this this problem because they... Sorry. So it's Mrs. Froy who knows the secret. She's trying to get out this melody.
Uh-huh.
So presumably they're... the simplest method is like, well, they need to take Mrs. Froy out now
mm-hmm.
that she's on the train. And also hide the one witness to Mrs. Froy's existence, I guess, who is Iris.
Yeah.
So that's why they start gaslighting her. But then it's like, they've got to both convince her that it never happened and that it was just her head injury. They somehow have to call ahead and get this, like, decoy... accident victim.
That was what I was going to bring up. It's like they somehow were able to call ahead and get an accident victim or, like, you know, a cadaver, like a body to use
mm-hmm.
to wrap up and be like, okay, this is the only way we're going to get Mrs. Froy off this train without anybody seeing her.
Mm-hmm.
And then also have a nun, which is there with her for some
who turns
reason.
Out to not be a foreign agent.
Who turns
in
out
in the end, she's just a British... It seemed like she was maybe a double agent. Because she turns out to be British rather than... German or whatever it was.
Yeah,
and then she ends up helping them, right?
Yeah, she ends up helping them. I thought it was because she, like, had just changed sides.
Oh.
And was like, I don't care about him. He clearly doesn't care about our well-being. I'll help you all
yeah.
escape or I'll help you out of this. But yeah, they somehow had to call ahead, arrange all of that in a matter of, like, I guess a couple of hours.
Uh-huh.
And those two just happen to be ready to go to get on that train and play the role of of a severely injured person and a nun.
Plus the two, I don't know if it was the conductor himself, but near the end of the movie, there's those two guys in the front compartment
yeah.
who, like, escape into the engine compartment and get killed in the end, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Or detach the train, maybe?
Yeah.
But anyway, so, like, there's a cook involved, because remember he throws out the evidence through that pot out the window?
Oh,
and
I just
then the
figured...
tea sticks to the thing?
Oh,
somebody threw out that evidence anyway, or, like,
yeah,
made that happen.
Yeah, I couldn't decide whether or not I thought that that was done knowingly, or if that was just like, oh, taking the trash, oh, there's a random tea bag in there. Well,
oh, I see. Well, yeah, it, that no could be. So, all this is to say, it's a very outlandish plot. Mm-hmm. There seems to be some plot holes if you start thinking about it. And it doesn't really add up to a whole lot. Like, the twists don't feel revelatory. It's not like suddenly, you know, you thought one thing and then, oh, it's actually a much more complicated thing. Mm-hmm. They felt more like out of nowhere.
And I feel like if Hitchcock had cared even the slightest bit more and taken a little bit more artistic liberty over it, he probably could have made some adjustments or some cuts. I don't know if they had any strict restrictions on how much editing or cutting they could do because it was based off of a book and, you know, what the writers were trying to do. But we had talked about this. Hitchcock apparently needed to do this film in order to get out of a contract so that he could then go to America to make films there. So he really didn't care about this. We
suspect.
Yeah, we suspect. But what's weird is that on the cover of the Criterion Collection, this was noted as one of his funniest films ever. And we saw this after 39 Steps, so I thought that was a bit insulting. Like, they were trying to pull a wool over our eyes or something. Like, they...
Oh my god, the entire... Not only is the movie The Lady Vanishes about gaslighting, the entire critical reaction to The Lady Vanishes is trying to gaslight us.
Oh my god.
Into... believing that it was the funniest movie.
It's full circle.
Yeah.
Wow. Maybe we aren't giving it enough credit. No, it still sucks.
This goes so much deeper. Well, now that you brought up sort of the context of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So what I found was that... I guess one nice thing was that the... copyright was not renewed on this movie because at the time it was released, copyrights were not nearly as long. It was like 30 years. And at the end of 30 years, the copyright holder was required to put in an official renewal application. Otherwise, it would fall into the public domain. So they let that happen in 1970 or 1968 or something. And what that meant is that, like a lot of things that fall into the public domain, unfortunately, for a long time, there were only pretty crappy versions of this movie to watch from people, like, making a quick buck, essentially. Oh. So, you know, there's a lot of VHS copies and, like, sixth-generation film prints and stuff like that.
Wow.
So I will give Criterion credit for taking the time to, like, get a really nice print of this movie and get it on Laserdisc for this home video release. So that at least, like, regardless of our feelings on it, it was critically extremely well received and a commercial blockbuster. And they felt that it was important that Hitchcock's earlier work be seen. And especially in, like, a nice way that people could appreciate. So I will definitely give them credit for that. I'm surprised that they didn't include any special features.
Yeah, this was the second one that releases. Didn't include special features, right?
Yeah, and that was after, like, their first two had tons of special features. There was commentaries and visual essays and, like, production notes and photos in the jacket and all that kind of stuff.
It's really interesting because if they put this one in the collection specifically to honor Hitchcock's earlier work, like, why wouldn't they offer any of that additional information? Maybe it was too hard to find some of that stuff because of all of the copyrighted versions. That wouldn't make a difference. I don't know. I would
unclear.
Think that there'd be so much information for them to include on this.
Mm-hmm. Well, something that they could have included that did end up included on the Blu-ray release of Lady Vanishes that Criterion put out much more recently was there was a French New Wave director named François Truffaut. He was one of the most famous French New Wave directors, and he was also a film critic and, like, historian. He wrote a lot, I think, for Cahiers du Cinéma, which was a really famous French film magazine. And he did a series of interviews with Hitchcock in the 60s, I believe, where they sat down with a translator, because Truffaut only spoke French, and had these discussions about Hitchcock's entire career. They went movie by movie, talking about techniques and actors and plots and the nature of suspense, all these kinds of things. And so I did, I'll put a link in the on the page for this podcast so that people can watch it. But I listened to the section on The Lady Vanishes, and it was entertaining to me because I told you this yesterday after I listened to it, that it was a surprisingly like kind of boring part of the interview. Truffaut, like, he just didn't seem to have very good questions to ask.
Were all of his questions not that great or compelling, or was it just for The Lady Vanishes that it suddenly kind of took a dive in terms of how interesting?
Right. I didn't listen to other segments, so I couldn't tell you for sure.
Okay. That's such a shame to have, like, an opportunity to interview Hitchcock and then, like, some bland reporter, like, gets that opportunity and kind of wastes the opportunity for all those questions. And
I have to assume that there were other much more meaningful segments because these interviews are quite well known still, and there was a giant book released that was a transcript of the entire set of interviews.
Wow, okay, great.
Yeah, so, like, I think there's other information in there about other movies that's much more interesting.
Okay, great.
For this movie, though, what was funny was that Truffaut brings it up, and he's just like, all right, so The Lady Vanishes. And then there's a pause, and Hitchcock just kind of grumbles. And then Hitchcock's like,
I bet he did.
Well, yes. The cinematography, yes. There was one shot, actually, that was interesting that we did. Where in the... he just talked about how in the cafe car, Gilbert and Iris are talking to the doctor, and the doctor has poisoned their drinks.
Mm-hmm.
And we spend the whole scene with them not drinking the drinks.
Mm-hmm.
And even at the time, Hitchcock knew it was a cliche for people to, like, receive a poisoned drink, almost drink it, not drink it, keep talking and stalling.
It's like a Chekhov's gun. It's like, okay, when is the drink going to be drank or poured over the edge of the train?
So he knew that he didn't want to do the usual thing of playing it up for comedy. And so he was just like, well, what if they just don't even touch the glass the whole scene? But we'll put the camera so that it looks through the glasses at Gilbert and Iris. So we know that they're present there the whole time, and we're waiting to see what's going to happen. But really, we're just focusing on them talking. And in order to pull off this shot, apparently he had oversized glasses made to put closer to the camera to, like, force the perspective a little bit.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Honestly, I don't even remember the shot, so I don't know that it was particularly good.
Yeah, no, now that you mention it, I only remember maybe, like, a couple of really quick snapshots of, you know, the frame of the camera going through the glass and then up to their faces. Mm-hmm. But it was so brief that, yeah, you know, it's easy to forget, like, how much work goes into a shot that you only see for a couple of seconds in film.
Yeah, like, that's true.
Yeah, like, whole sets and costumes developed for, you know, what could be less than 10 seconds. Mm-hmm. So that just, you know, breaks my brain a little bit. I guess it's easy to see why there's such expensive things to make. Mm-hmm. But I would want to see those glasses. Like, I assume it was one lens and he didn't actually have a pair of bifocals made specifically.
No, the wine glasses.
Oh!
You thought he was putting glasses over the camera?
I didn't. No. I figured that was, like, you know, not actually a pair of, like, frames that your grandparents would wear placed gently in front of the camera.
Right.
But, no, I definitely did not know you meant wine glasses.
Sorry, the poisoned wine glasses.
Got it.
He set them on the table very close to the camera, and the poisoned wine glasses, he had extra large wine glasses made.
There it is.
To make to pull off this angle that he wanted.
You know, I wonder if that's when they started making, like, the jumbo-sized wine glasses.
It was all his fault.
Like, yeah, yeah. Somebody saw that and was like, you know what? I bet there are some basic bitches who would love to drink a whole bottle of wine out of that glass.
There it is.
And you know what? They were right. It's still being made to this day. Yeah. Thanks, Hitchcock.
Well,
I mean, thank you, Hitchcock. Thank you.
Yeah. So, I can at least say that, like, technically, there's a lot of very good, like, subtle use of visual effects, essentially, in the movie. Mm-hmm. I'll give them that. Like, it's difficult to make a movie in such cramped quarters, like a train.
Mm-hmm.
He told Truffaut that the whole movie was shot on a 90-foot set that they had built.
Whoa.
Of a train interior.
90 feet is not that much.
Right. And they had they'd rearrange things, and like they had one extra compartment built for like some other shots. But yeah, they were in tight quarters, and it's difficult to come up with good camera angles in tight quarters. I know that from experience. On the other hand, what that means is that, like, generally the cinematography in this movie is not really something that you notice. Mm-hmm. Like, it's adequate. Tells the story. There's a lot of wide shots.
The only shots I thought would be somewhat difficult is, like, whenever they look on the outside of the train. It's like, oh, do they actually take this shot from a train, or were they just, like...
Right.
I guess I would have had to. Anyways, there were a couple of shots where I figured, for that time, it must have been somewhat difficult to coordinate or plan this.
The one that sticks out is Gilbert sort of... I think he's trying to climb out of a window in order to move to another car. And there is one impressive special effects shot where they cut to the outside of the train at that point. You see him leaning out, and an oncoming train is on the other track.
Classic.
Yeah, and he has to, like, whoop, and Iris helps pull him back in so he doesn't get decapitated.
Yeah, because he was close.
Yeah, by this other train. That was a good one.
Yeah.
Other than that...
That was the most suspense I felt during the entire movie.
Yeah, I would agree. There are a lot of, like... They do a good job of, I think they're called process shots, of, like, making the windows out... The scenery outside the windows appear to move.
Mm.
And you can do that in various ways. There's just sort of, like, faking lights moving outside the train by swiveling lights on stands. You can do rear projection, where they've recorded a passing scenery on a real train, and then they just, like, play that on a screen behind the set, stuff like that. And they do... That's what I meant by subtle visual effects, is, like, you don't really notice it, but it helps sell the illusion that this is all on a real train. And stuff like the sound, too. Like, it does have the train sound through the whole movie, just the rattle on the tracks and stuff like that. The train whistles, and so on. So, like, it's not... badly made.
Right.
They, you know, he did a lot with what he had to work with. It just seems like there was a lot of potential for more. And as you pointed out, you know, from reading about the production, it sure sounds like he just needed to knock this one out so that he could get to Hollywood, because
he did it for the passport.
Yeah. He was on contract with Gaumont British, which is a famous British film company. I think they might have also done the previous one, 39 Steps. He had one movie left to fulfill his contract, and I read specifically that he did not have a script. He didn't have an idea. He wasn't sure what he wanted to do. And so Gaumont said, well, we have this project that we actually tried to make last year and it fell apart. It was The Lady Vanishes. It was called something different at the time, but it was based on this book, and they had spent a year trying to make the movie with a different director.
Why were they having such a hard time?
Political upheaval. So the previous director started the movie.
Excuses.
Yeah, and they went into production. They had a second unit going out and doing all of these, second unit being sort of the extra shots that don't involve the main actors. They went to Yugoslavia to get the stuff that they needed, and while they were in Yugoslavia, there was some kind of uprising that happened.
Oh, shit.
I forget which one, but it it meant that they had to get out of the country, basically. Close it all up. Like, we got to go back to Britain because we're just not going to get the kind of permissions that we need in order to shoot where we need to with all of this going on.
And that was after about a year of them already trying to...
Yes.
Wow.
I don't think they had been in Yugoslavia a full year, but they had been in production for a year. So that would include the writing of the script, the casting, getting the crew together.
Okay,
and then sending
sense.
Them out.
So I was remembering... So one of the latest movies that we watched together was Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
Yeah.
And I remember reading, because they also have a TV show that came out about the development of that movie, was that they only shot for, I think, a couple of weeks. I think it was like 4 weeks or something like that. I want to say it was like an incredibly intense time to get all those shots. But I guess it's also easy to forget what you had mentioned is like all the complicated shots that needed to happen in the train, which meant they were very limited and needed specific like supplies to get those effects. So I guess when you put it that way, that it makes sense that it'd be much more complicated to get.
Yeah. I really don't think there were any, to my recollection, there weren't any special effect shots in Baby Jane.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make it like a ton easier, but generally it's a matter of time. Like, it takes time to set up effect shots and do the processing and find the crew who can do it and all that kind of stuff. So in any case, they scrapped it. They said, let's just shelve it, we'll work on something else. So I think the head of the studio hands the script to Hitchcock, says, well, what do you think of this? Hitchcock reads it. He says, well, this is fine. I could see maybe doing something with this, so...
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, he takes it, they revise it a little further, he works with the writers to, I think, add some of the characters, chop some things up, add a little bit more suspense and intrigue. I think some of the political elements were Hitchcock's ideas, and his wife's as well, Alma, who worked on this movie as continuity.
Way to go, Alma.
Yep. And, so he took it on and said, great, we can do this. And, when he was talking with Truffaut, as I mentioned, he barely had anything to say about it. And then he did say something very funny about, like, how outlandish the plot was. Like, even he thought it was ridiculous that there were so many agents on this train all working together to, like, pull this conspiracy out of nowhere.
And somehow still couldn't knock off the old lady.
Yeah.
Or they wanted to keep her alive for the brain surgery. Was that surgery actually really going to happen, or was that still just part of their cover? Because I don't think that was even clarified now that
I don't think I'm thinking on it. Yeah, it wasn't. They must have had to keep her alive, because otherwise they would have just thrown her off the train and shot her.
Yeah, and that was a point that Hitchcock made about why he didn't care for the movie, because it just seemed so ridiculous that, like, Mrs. Freud was this big spy that for some reason was able to thwart this whole operation that was aboard the train.
Mm-hmm.
With the help of those mangy kids and that dog. Oh, I totally messed up the Scooby-Doo.
You did.
Thing.
That's okay.
If it wasn't for you kids and that dog. No, I'm like so close and yet
you'll
so
get there.
Far.
And I would have gotten away with it too
if it
wasn't for you.
Yes?
Meddling kids.
Okay, so
it is
meddling.
Yeah. Meddling teenagers.
Gosh.
I can't get it either. You can look it up at home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Google it right now. It's of the utmost importance.
There you go. Now that we've ripped this movie apart mercilessly, we come to the final question of every episode, which is, given Criterion's mission statement of releasing important classic and contemporary films, do you think, knowing everything about the critical reception, the blockbuster status, and what we think of the film, that it should be included?
I would say an emphatic no.
I would also say an emphatic no. Especially given that the previous movie in the collection is The 39 Steps, which we both felt was so much better.
Yeah. And even like the shots weren't that special. Like, there was nothing that made it stand out to me as something that belongs as part of the Criterion collection. I could not say it in any other different way.
And there you have it. Two thumbs down for the first time in the history of this very long-running podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, there will not be many more of those. Thank you all so much for listening to this latest episode. Thank you very much for recording this with me.
Thanks for having me.
You know, trapped in our apartment together during the time of quarantine.
Yeah.
And with that, I hope you all are staying safe and healthy.
Stay inside.